16. By the time he arrived at Kennelly's, a queer obscurity had come over the northern horizon, and he knew it was dust. Over Tull, the air was still dead quiet. Kennelly was waiting for him on the chaff-strewn stage that was the floor of his barn.
"Leaving?"
he grinned abjectly at the gunslinger. "Yeah."
"Not before the storm?"
"Ahead of it."
"The wind goes faster than any man on a mule. In the open, it can kill you."
"I want the mule now," the gunslinger said simply.
"Sure."
But Kennelly did not turn away, merely stood, as if searching for something further to say, grinning his groveling, hate-filled grin, and his eyes flicked up and over the gunslinger's shoulder. The gunslinger sidestepped and turned at the same time, and the heavy stick of stovewood that the girl Subi held swished through the air, grazing his elbow only. She lost hold of it with the force of her swing, and it clattered over the floor. In the explosive height of the loft, barn swallows took shadowed wing. The girl looked at him bovinely, her breasts thrust with overripe grandeur at the wash-faded shirt she wore. One thumb sought the haven of her mouth with dreamlike slowness. The gunslinger turned back to Kennelly. Kennelly's grin was huge. His skin was waxy yellow. His eyes rolled in their sockets.
"Aye,"
he began in a phlegm-filled whisper and could not continue. "The mule," the gunslinger prodded gently.
"Sure, sure, sure,"
Kennelly whispered, the grin now touched with incredulity that he should still be alive. He shuffled to get it. The gunslinger moved to where he could watch the man go. The hostler brought the mule back and handed him the bridle.
"You get it and tend your sister,"
he said to Subi. Subi tossed her head and didn't move. The gunslinger left them there, staring at each other across the dusty, dropping-strewn floor, he with a sick grin, she with dumb, inanimate defiance. Outside, the heat was still like a hammer. 17. He walked the mule up the center of the street, his boots sending up squirts of dust. His water bags, swollen with water, were strapped across the mule's back. He stopped at the Tonk, but Allie was not there. The place was deserted, battened down for the storm, but still dirty from the night before. It stank of sour beer. He filled his tote sack with cornmeal, dried and roasted corn, and half of the raw hamburg in the cooler. He left 4 gold pieces stacked on the planked counter. Allie did not come down. Sheb's piano bid him a silent, yellow-toothed toodaloo. He stepped back out and cinched the tote sack across the mule's back. There was a tight feeling in his throat. He might still avoid the trap, but the chances were small. He was, after all, the interloper. He walked past the shuttered, waiting buildings, feeling the eyes that peered through cracks and chinks. The man in black had played God in Tull. He had spoken of a king's child, a red prince. Was it only a sense of the cosmic comic, or a matter of desperation? It was a question of some importance. There was a shrill, harried scream from behind him, and doors suddenly threw themselves open. Forms lunged. The trap was sprung. Men in long handles and men in dirty dungarees, women in slacks and in faded dresses, even children tagging after their parents, and in every hand there was a chunk of wood or a knife. His reaction was automatic, instantaneous, inbred. He whirled on his heels while his hands pulled the guns from their holsters, the butts heavy and sure in his hands. It was Allie. And of course it had to be Allie, coming at him with her face distorted, the scar a hellish purple in the lowering light. He saw that she was held hostage. The distorted, grimacing face of Sheb peered over her shoulder like a witch's familiar. She was his shield and sacrifice. He saw it all, clear and shadowless, in the frozen, deathless light of the sterile calm, and heard her.
"Kill me, Roland, kill me! I said the word, 19, I said, and he told me, again, Barrett."
The hands were trained to give her what she wanted. He was the last of his breed, and it was not only his mouth that knew the high speech. The guns beat their heavy, atonal music into the air. Her mouth flapped, and she sagged, and the guns fired again. The last expression on her face might have been gratitude. Sheb's head snapped back. They both fell into the dust. "They've gone to the land of 19," he thought. "Whatever is there." Sticks flew through the air, rained on him. He staggered, fended them off. One with a nail pounded raggedly through it, ripped at his arm and drew blood. A man with a beard stubble and sweat-stained armpits lunged, flying at him with a dull kitchen knife held in one paw. The gunslinger shot him dead, and the man thumped into the street. His false teeth shot out as his chin struck and grinned, spit shiny in the dirt. "Satan!" someone was screaming. "The accursed! Bring him down!" "The interloper!" another voice cried. Sticks rained on him. A knife struck his boot and bounced. "The interloper! The Antichrist!" He blasted his way through the middle of them, running as the bodies fell, his hands picking the targets with ease and dreadful accuracy. Two men and a woman went down, and he ran through the hole they left. He led them a feverish parade across the street and toward the rickety general store barbershop that faced Sheb's. He mounted the boardwalk, turned again, and fired the rest of his loads into the charging crowd. Behind them, Sheb and Allie and the others lay crucified in the dust. They never hesitated or faltered, although every shot he fired found a vital spot, and they had probably never seen a gun. He retreated, moving his body like a dancer to avoid the flying missiles. He reloaded as he went, with a rapidity that had also been trained into his fingers. They shuttled busily between gun belts and cylinders. The mob came up over the boardwalk, and he stepped into the general store and rammed the door closed. The large display window to the right shattered inward, and three men crowded through. Their faces were zealously blank, their eyes filled with bland fire. He shot them all, and the two that followed them. They fell in the window, hung on the jutting shards of glass, choking the opening. The door crashed and shuddered with their weight, and he could hear her voice, "The killer! Your souls! The cloven hoof!" The door ripped off its hinges and fell straight in, making a flat hand clap. Dust puffed up from the floor. Men, women, and children charged him. Spittle and stovewood flew. He shot his guns empty, and they fell like ninepins in a game of points. He retreated into the barber shop, shoving over a flour barrel, rolling it at them, throwing a pan of boiling water that contained two nicked straight razors. They came on, screaming with frantic incoherency. From somewhere, Sylvia Pitston exhorted them, her voice rising and falling in blind inflections. He pushed shells into hot chambers, smelling the aromas of shave and tonsure, smelling his own flesh as the calluses at the tips of his fingers singed. He went through the back door and onto the porch. The flat scrubland was at his back now, flatly denying the town that crouched against its dirty haunch. Three men hustled around the corner with large betrayer grins on their faces. They saw him seeing them, and the grins curdled in the second before he mowed them down. A woman had followed them, howling. She was large and fat and known to the patrons of Sheb's as Aunt Mill. The gunslinger blew her backwards, and she landed in a whorish sprawl, her skirt rucked up between her thighs. He went down the steps and walked backwards into the desert, 10 paces, 20. The back door of the barber shop flew open, and they boiled out. He caught a glimpse of Sylvia Pitston. He opened up. They fell in squats. They fell backwards. They tumbled over the railing into the dust. They cast no shadows in the deathless purple light of the day. He realized he was screaming. He had been screaming all along. His eyes felt like cracked ball bearings. His balls had drawn up against his belly. His legs were wood. His ears were iron. The guns were empty, and they boiled at him, transmogrified into an eye and a hand, and he stood, screaming and reloading, his mind far away and absent, letting his hands do their reloading trick. Could he hold up a hand, tell them he had spent 1,000 years learning this trick and others, tell them of the guns and the blood that had blessed them? Not with his mouth, but his hands, could speak their own tale. They were in throwing range as he finished reloading, and a stick struck him on the forehead and brought blood in abraded drops. In 2 seconds they would be in gripping distance. In the forefront he saw Kennerly. Kennerly's younger daughter, perhaps 11, Subi, 2 male barflies, a whore named Amy Felden. He let them all have it, and the ones behind them. Their bodies thumped like scarecrows. Blood and brains flew in streamers. They halted for a moment, startled, the mob face shivering into individual, bewildered faces. A man ran in a large, screaming circle. A woman with blisters on her hands turned her head up and cackled feverishly at the sky. The man whom he had first seen sitting gravely on the steps of the mercantile store made a sudden and amazing load in his pants. He had time to reload one gun. Then it was Sylvia Pitston, running at him, waving a wooden cross in each hand. "Devil! Devil! Devil! Child killer! Monster! Destroy him, brothers and sisters! Destroy the child-killing interloper!" He put a shot into each of the cross pieces, blowing the roods to splinters, and 4 more into the woman's head. She seemed to accordion into herself and waver like a shimmer of heat. They all stared at her for a moment in tableau, while the gunslinger's fingers did their reloading trick. The tips of his fingers sizzled and burned. Neat circles were branded into the tips of each one. There were fewer of them now. He had run through them like a mower's scythe. He thought they would break with the woman dead, but someone threw a knife. The hilt struck him squarely between the eyes and knocked him over. They ran at him in a reaching, vicious clot. He fired his guns empty again, lying in his own spent shells. His head hurt, and he saw large brown circles in front of his eyes. He missed with one shot, downed 11 with the rest. But they were on him, the ones that were left. He fired the 4 shells he had reloaded, and then they were beating him, stabbing him. He threw a pair of them off his left arm and rolled away. His hands began doing their infallible trick. He was stabbed in the shoulder. He was stabbed in the back. He was hit across the ribs. He was stabbed in the ass with what might have been a meat fork. A small boy squirmed at him and made the only deep cut across the bulge of his calf. The gunslinger blew his head off. They were scattering, and he let them have it again, back shooting now. The ones left began to retreat toward the sand-colored pitted buildings, and still the hands did their business, like over-eager dogs that want to do their rolling-over trick for you, not once or twice, but all night, and the hands were cutting them down as they ran. The last one made it as far as the steps of the barbershop's back porch, and then the gunslinger's bullet took him in the back of the head. "Yelp!" the man cried, and fell over. It was Tull's final word on the business. Silence came back in, filling jagged spaces. The gunslinger was bleeding from perhaps 20 different wounds, all of them shallow except for the cut across his calf. He bound it with a strip of shirt, and then straightened and examined his kill. They trailed in a twisting, zigzagging path from the back door of the barbershop to where he stood. They lay in all positions. None of them seemed to be sleeping. He followed the trail of death, counting as he went. In the general store, one man sprawled with his arms wrapped lovingly around the cracked candy jar he had dragged down with him. He ended up where he had started, in the middle of the deserted main street. He had shot and killed 39 men, 14 women, and 5 children. He had shot and killed everyone in Tull. A sickish sweet odor came to him on the first of the dry, stirring wind. He followed it, then looked up and nodded. The decaying body of Nort was spread-eagled atop the plank roof of Sheb's, crucified with wooden pegs. Mouth and eyes were open. The mark of a large and purple cloven hoof had been pressed into the skin of his grimy forehead. The gunslinger walked out of town. His mule was standing in a clump of weed about 40 yards further along the remnant of the coach road. The gunslinger led it back to Kennerly's stable. Outside, the wind was playing a jag-time tune. He put the mule up for the time being and went back to the tonk. He found a ladder in the back shed, went up to the roof, and cut Nort loose. The body was lighter than a bag of sticks. He tumbled it down to join the common people, those who would only have to die once. Then he went back inside, ate hamburgers, and drank three beers while the light failed and the sand began to fly. That night he slept in the bed where he and Allie had lain. He had no dreams. The next morning the wind was gone, and the sun was its usual bright and forgetful self. The bodies had gone south like tumbleweeds with the wind. At mid-morning, after he had bound all his cuts, he moved on as well. 18. He thought Brown had fallen asleep. The fire was down to no more than a spark, and the bird Zoltan had put his head under his wing. Just as he was about to get up and spread a pallet in the corner, Brown said, "There! You've told it. Do you feel better?" The gunslinger started. "Why would I feel bad?" "You're human," you said. "No demon. Or did you lie?"
"I didn't lie."
He felt the grudging admittance in him. He liked Brown, honestly did, and he hadn't lied to the dweller in any way.
"Who are you, Brown? Really, I mean."
"Just me," he said, unperturbed.
"Why do you have to think you're in the middle of such a mystery?" The gunslinger lit a smoke without replying.
"I think you're very close to your man in black," Brown said. "Is he desperate?"
"I don't know."
"Are you?"
"Not yet," the gunslinger said.
He looked at Brown with a shade of defiance.
"I go where I have to go. Do what I have to do."
"That's good, then," Brown said,
and turned over and went to sleep. 19. The next morning, Brown fed him and sent him on his way. In the daylight, he was an amazing figure with his scrawny, sunburnt chest, pencil-like collarbones, and loony shock of red hair, the bird perched on his shoulder. "The mule?" the gunslinger asked.
"I'll eat it," Brown said.
"Okay."
Brown offered his hand, and the gunslinger shook it. The dweller nodded to the southeast.
"Walk easy. Long days and pleasant nights.
May you have twice the number."
They nodded at each other, and then the man Allie had called Roland walked away, his body festooned with guns and water. He looked back once. Brown was rooting furiously at his little corn bed. The crow was perched on the low roof of his dwelling, like a gargoyle. 20. The fire was down, and the stars had begun to pale off. The wind walked restlessly, told its tale to no one. The gunslinger twitched in his sleep and was still again. He dreamed a thirsty dream. In the darkness, the shape of the mountains was invisible. Any thoughts of guilt, any feelings of regret had faded. The desert had baked them out. He found himself thinking more and more about Court, who had taught him to shoot. Court had known black from white. He stirred again and woke. He blinked at the dead fire with its own shape superimposed over the other, more geometrical one. He was a romantic. He knew it, and he guarded the knowledge jealously. It was a secret he had shared with only a few over the years. The girl named Susan, the girl from Medjis, had been one of them. That, of course, made him think of Court again. Court was dead. They were all dead, except for him. The world had moved on. The gunslinger shouldered his gunner and moved on with it.